welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are broadcasting live from the 9th Annual Columbus Public Health Department's Farmers Market at the Health Department headquarters at 240 Parsons Avenue. Everyone is welcome. We'll be here until noon. I am so glad some people have already dropped by who are listening on the radio or watching it online an hour ago. For more information, check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. You know, and this is our third year in a row at this farmers market. Every year we talk about the issues of farming. This year, the biggest issue is the future of the farm bill pending in Congress right now. Earlier this month, the House passed a farm bill by a narrow margin, just 216 to 208, foreshadowing tough times ahead, resolving that version with the Senate version. One of the biggest issues is the removal of funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, more commonly thought of as food stamps. Coming up later, we'll hear about what SNAP means to Ohio from the state agency that doles out that benefit. Joining us now to talk about the politics of SNAP and other elements of the farm bill that are creating another logjam in Congress is Columbus Dispatch Washington correspondent Jessica Wehrman. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jessica, the farm bill renewed every 5 years is traditionally a solid bipartisan measure that bucks the usual polarization of Congress to get things done for the nation's farmers and our poor by combining those two interests. Both sides win. It's a no-brainer. What happened this year?
Well, this year, one of the most controversial things, actually, let me back up a little bit.
Sure.
So, traditionally, you're right, it has been a bipartisan bill, and if there were any alliances, they were more of regional in nature than partisan in nature. For example, certain farmers in the South who, appreciated a subsidy for this product or that product would be allied together. And traditionally, it has been, the farm bill has included SNAP, or federal food stamp programs, I guess, traditionally. This year they tried to have a vote in, I guess, mid-June. The House put up, and everyone kind of expected it to pass, as it always has. But what happened was that the Democrats rebelled against the bill because they believed that there were far too many cuts to food stamps. And about 60 Republicans rebelled against it because they didn't think there were enough cuts to food stamps. So between the two of them, the bill went down. And, it was very surprising.
It was about $2 billion in cuts out of $6 billion.
Yeah, I mean, the Senate has already passed its own version of the farm bill, and it was there were cuts, but not as significant. So Democrats just did not like the idea of cuts that were this sweeping and deep.
Yes. So now the SNAP provision has been scuttled entirely in the House version. The Senate version still has some funding for SNAP, but assuming the SNAP provision is scuttled, what would happen to it? They're talking about another appropriations bill. What would they do?
Well, there's a lot of different scenarios that could play out in this case. The first thing that could happen is that the House could miraculously pass its version of a SNAP bill, and then the House and Senate could come together and pass something. But it seems very unlikely because the current bill expires September 30th. The other thing that could happen is that the House and Senate could appropriate funds. Right now, food stamps are an entitlement, and so basically they could be paid for through appropriations without any authorization being passed. I mean, that is an option, and it happens in a lot of cases. There are instances where the appropriations committees pass and actually write the checks as opposed to the authorization bills who say, you're permitted to spend this money. So that's an option as well. Now, looking ahead, I don't know what this year is going to look like in terms of appropriations as we approach that October 1st deadline. So, I mean, This sort of leaves kind of open the question of what happens if they can't agree on appropriating this particular bill. I mean, do they pass a continuing resolution? Is there going to be some sort of funding standoff, as it seems like there is every year now? So there's a lot of questions as to what happens next. And also, another question that is kind of lingering in my mind is, can they go to conference when there's, these bills are so very different. I mean, can they just go ahead and pass a Senate bill in the House? And I think that's kind of a non-starter.
I was going to ask you what the significance is of putting the food stamp program in the agriculture appropriation bill instead of the farm bill. Anti-hunger activists say that that's dangerous to the program. Why would it endanger the program? Is it less stable when it's in an appropriation bill?
Well, it becomes a quick target. The appropriations committees are always under some sort of pressure to cut funds, and it's without an authorizing legislation to kind of back it up and say, yes, you're supposed to, appropriations committee, you're supposed to spend this money. It does make it less secure. And, they're looking for places to cut left and right, and so, this would be a possible target. Now, keep in mind, school nutrition programs are not in to my knowledge, in the agriculture bills, but they're appropriated as well. And I think hunger activists are concerned as well that, if SNAP gets cut in appropriations bills, what does that mean for the fate of things like the school lunch program?
And the women, infants, and children also are
absolutely
not in the farm bill, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Jessica Wehrman. She is a Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch. House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin wants to turn food stamps into a capped payment to the states. Now, I've heard this isn't going anywhere, but what does that mean, a capped payment to states? Is that what you were talking about earlier, or is this something different?
I don't believe I was talking about it earlier. There were a lot of proposals that were floated in the farm bill, including the original one that failed to pass the House. And that was one of the ones that's been discussed and one that he's proposed. I think that that's kind of a controversial idea, particularly among hunger activists who are concerned that would basically have the effect of kicking people off of these nutrition programs who really need it.
Joining us now is Joe Carnelli. He's Senior Director for Corporate Communications for the Ohio Farm Bureau. Thanks for joining us today, Joe.
Thanks for the invitation, Ann. This is a really great venue down here.
I know, that's right. We are at the Columbus Health Public Health Department's Farmers Market. It's their 9th annual Farmers Market, and we are broadcasting live today. So Joe said he's never been here before, and he's impressed.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. Ohio's farmers got the sweet corn coming in and all the zucchini and the squash and the berries and tomatoes. So it's a great opportunity, and I'm probably going to fill up a grocery bag when I leave today.
You're making my mouth water, Joe.
I know, Jessica. It's really nice. I'm sorry you're on the phone.
I know.
Next year you'll have to travel here. Jessica and Joe, jump in. Why have the subsidies been reexamined every 5 years, and what is the significance of making the increased farm subsidies permanent? So what's this five-year, pattern that's been established? Jessica, where's that from?
Well, I mean, so the original farm bill programs began in the 1930s and 40s, and they're permanent law, but the idea has been, to my knowledge, and Joe, please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, that traditionally, since about the 70s, they've kind of revisited this every 5 years with the idea of, let's sort of make sure that this program works for us for 5 years and we can sort of tweak it. I mean, it's all sort of, and it's not uncommon for bills to be reauthorized every 5 or 6 years. I mean, transportation, for example, is traditionally a 6-year bill. So that's been the case, that they've kind of revisited the program every 5 years. And what I think has farmers worried is if you make this permanent, it's a lot harder to change permanent law. And also maybe there's a little less incentive to pass law because, right now if this September 30th passes and there's no authorization bill, we revert back to our 1930s and 40s law.
Yeah, Jessica, this is Joe. I think you got it exactly right. The fact of the matter is things change, and what's important to us as a nation may change over 5 years. We may have more needs to serve the needy. There may be a major change in crop production around the world. There may be new technologies that farmers now have that they didn't have before, all of these things that are influencing the food we put on our table. And so it's a good idea to revisit every 5 years our nation's policy towards food production and take in all of the new factors in the world around us as we try and shape that legislation. The other part, too, on in terms of why not make this permanent as opposed to the former law, Yvonne Lasiska, who's our policy director in this area, she puts it pretty good. Having a permanent law serves as the hammer. It makes Congress pay attention to this because there's so many provisions in the old law that nobody's going to like, that it forces them to take on this issue every 5 years.
Joe, another criticism is that the payments, by and large, go to the subsidies and so forth that are part of the Farm Bill, go to the largest and wealthiest farmers, and that it's not helping smaller farmers. Earlier this year, the Agriculture Department projected the farm income in 2013 would be $128 billion, the highest since 1973, fueled by record crop production levels and high prices for many crops. I mean, a lot of people are worried that if you freeze it at these levels, it may not be fair over time.
Well, fairness is in the eye of the beholder.
Right?
I would suggest that when... First of all, I'm glad that we're looking at various sides of this question, because mm-hmm. the narrative that we hear is Donald Trump and Scottie Pippen and all of the big name stars are getting all the money. The reality is that 98% of the farms in America are family farms. The way we have the system set up now, we generally tend to support agriculture based on a per bushel or per unit of production. And so that's why you do see that larger farms do receive a larger share of the farm support prices. There's a lot of discussion as to whether or not that's fair. And I think that's a reasonable discussion to have. Frozen over
time.
Well,
if it's made permanent.
Well, what will happen with the enabling legislation, mm-hmm. not the dollar levels, are what's permanent.
Okay.
And so that's why. Now, there are certain things, like in the milk bill and those, or the milk portion of the bill, those kind of things are permanent. But generally, it's the process and the concept that would be permanent. The actual dollar figures are usually up for negotiation.
Now, you mentioned the 98% of farmers in America are family farms, and that's absolutely right. But family farms... there's a really broad definition of family farms. They can be some of the biggest farms in the country.
They absolutely can. And you know, when we often hear the term corporate agriculture, mostly the family corporation is grandpa's the chairman of the board and dad's the president and the sons and daughters are the vice presidents and so on. You're right. There are some extremely large family operations. The most of them, though, don't tend to fit in that. And I think if you look at the statistics, I don't know what exactly they are, but it's something on the order of the top 5% of farms in America produce close to 80% of all of our food. So that mm-hmm. that bears out what you're saying, that there are some very large family enterprises.
What about your constituency? Are they across the board happy with the way this is, or are there different? Are you serving different masters when you're talking about it?
That's one of the challenges that at the Ohio Farm Bureau, we're a general farm organization, mm-hmm. and so we have 70,000 masters. we have farmers who, our state president, I mentioned Hirsch Fruit Farm. They're selling their wares here at the farmer's market.
The Hirsch Fruit Farm.
Yeah, they're a produce grower. We have had members on our board, and they reflect our members who farm tens of thousands of acres of corn and soybeans. We have members who are just trying to get started with a niche operation of maybe starting a CSA in an organic farm. So to answer your original question, are they all happy? Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we have Farm Bureau, to hammer out those differences. But there's a lot of different views on what's the right way to do this.
We are talking about the Farm Bill. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. My guests, Jessica Werman of the Washington Bureau for the Columbus Dispatch, and also Joe Corneli. He's the Senior Director for Corporate Communications at the Ohio Farm Bureau. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are broadcasting live from the 9th Annual Columbus Public Health Farmers Market at the Health Department headquarters at 240 Parsons Avenue. Everyone's welcome. We'll be here until noon. Drop by and say hello and check out the beautiful produce on sale here. This is the first of three markets. For more information, check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. On July 11th, the House passed a farm bill, but by a narrow margin, without one Democratic vote, and with plenty of controversy after the funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, the food stamp program, was nixed. The conflict may be resolved when Senate and House committees convene in a conference committee to work out a compromise. Joining us now to talk about what the... Continuing our conversation about the farm bill is Jessica Wehrman. She is a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau, and also with us right here at the Farmers Market, Joe Corneli with the of the Ohio Farm Bureau. Since the 1970s, the expiration of the five-year farm bills has been an opportunity, and Joe, you kind of got at this a little bit earlier, to enact all kinds of changes and modernizations to the Agriculture Department programs, for example. That was how the agency was given the authority to encourage the development of farmers markets just like this around the country, and also to help organic farmers.
Yeah, that's one of the current discussions that we're having within the farm community is the face of agriculture is changing, and we hear that, well, the small farmers no longer exist. Well, actually, it's the fastest growing segment of the agricultural population. The dichotomy is these smaller operators are growing, the kind of folks perhaps we're seeing here at the farmers market. The far end of the spectrum, the large commodity production, that's getting bigger. Fewer farmers there, but bigger farmers. And so there's a lot of discussion of, okay, we have limited resources in Washington. We want to support agriculture. It's good public policy. How do we divvy that up? And I think the smaller operator is becoming more vocal in, look, we're a legitimate part of feeding America. We should have some federal assistance as we try to enhance our businesses like the larger scale commodity producers have.
So, Jessica Wehrman, in Washington, who represents those smaller, medium-sized and small farmers? Because we know the big farmers can afford to hire their own lobbyists.
Well, I mean, I think that their constituents, I mean, as Joe was mentioning, you know, there are small farmers in his group, and then there are other farm organizations as well. So, I do think that, you know, as we focus on sort of healthful eating, that the small farmers are becoming a little bit more vocal. There's some more attention being paid. I mean, Michelle Obama's got her own garden, for goodness sake. So I don't know that there's heavy-hitting lobbyists, but, the attention is definitely being paid.
The House... when I was reading up on this, I saw a lot of criticism or a lot of concern that so much focus is on the SNAP program and that all these other issues are not getting the attention they should get.
Well, it's a huge part of the bill. I mean, I think, am I right here, Joe? It's like 80% of the funding in the bill.
80% of the total farm bill goes to SNAP. Women's, infants, and children, school lunches. 80% of the farm bill is nutrition spending.
Now, I thought that the school nutrition programs and the women, infant, and children is not in the farm bill.
I thought that was appropriation.
Now, well, it's appropriated through appropriations, but the legislation for it is within the farm bill, is my understanding.
Okay. So, Jessica, is that kind of what people are hot about, is the SNAP programs?
Yeah, I mean, it's really rapidly growing, and in part because we've had a very weak economy lately. One in seven Americans is apparently eligible. And so a lot of the concern, you know, I've been talking this week to some of the folks who were really would push for more, they would say reforms to the program. Their concern is that, you know, people are taking the food stamps and who might be eligible to work, and it's a deterrent from them finding work. I mean, there were some amendments that were in the original bill that were aimed at, that they would have said were reforming it, but hunger activists would say that they were actually just kind of kicking people who were on food stamps unnecessarily off of it. I know the Secretary of Agriculture said like 92% of those who are eligible for food stamps are actually the elderly, children, the disabled, you know, people who really, really need this to survive.
Joe Corneli, your group isn't necessarily supportive of removing the SNAP.
No, we think it's a really bad idea, for a couple of reasons. farmers aren't the only part of the food chain. These people who are here utilizing their SNAP benefits are a part of the food chain as well. And so it's the right thing to do is to have a sound policy discussion on how do we help people meet their nutritional needs. So we think that needs to be connected to the production side of things as well. The other side, it's political. If I'm a lawmaker in New York City or Los Angeles, I've got next to zero knowledge of or interest in the Farm Bill. If I am a lawmaker in Iowa or Nebraska or the Southern Plains, I don't have that big of a population, so I'm not that interested in what's going on with the food programs. It takes a political coalition, or at least in the past it has, taken the political coalition of the nutrition interests and the production interests to get a farm bill passed. As Jessica's pointed out really well, though, years of history, tradition of cooperation, collaboration, it's gotten side railed this year, and it's pretty disappointing.
You know, some of that's changing because of the economy. It's true for the most part there's going to be more SNAP program participants in the big cities, but it's changing in the rural areas. One of the biggest critics of SNAP, Representative Stephen Fincher, he's a Republican from Tennessee, 22% of his constituents are participants in the SNAP.
Yeah, we have we think about the food assistance programs being primarily urban, but there are a lot of rural areas, and you don't even have to travel to Tennessee to see that. Mm-hmm. Parts of Appalachia and Ohio,
right.
Really, there's a lot of people that need some help. And so, yeah, it's unfortunately the need to help people has expanded.
There was a fascinating Washington Post series about hunger, and it was entirely located in a rural setting. I mean, this is a problem for cities and for urban areas. And I do want to point out that the original food stamp program included some agriculture, some sweeteners, if you will, for farmers, because at the time, they needed the support of rural communities to get food stamps passed through. So this has been a very, very long tradition of these two programs being linked.
We're talking about the Farm Bill right now. If you have a question or comment for our guests, Jessica Warman of the Columbus Dispatch and Joe Corneli of the Ohio Farm Bureau, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us. Oops, sorry, we're not emailing today, just 614-292-8513.
You're so old-fashioned.
I'm just tired. It's hard to untrain me. Julie in Franklinton, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Julie.
Hi, I read about an amendment to the Farm Bill, which was going to put responsibility for keeping people safe from foodborne illnesses in fresh produce on the farmer. And I wonder if, say, for instance, if there's a discussion, if 1 million people eat lettuce and 100 people get sick, how much of it is related to their own personal health? And if that ever gets to be part of the discussion. So I'll take my call off the air.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Julie.
Yeah, whether it's within the Farm Bill or not, I'm not sure, but there is this continuing conversation that's going on that Julie references, and it has to do largely with produce safety, and it's an issue that our produce growers have been very heavily engaged with. And yeah, the gist of it is they want to get another layer of food safety back on the production side of things and monitoring what's going on at the farm, because as Julie rightfully points out, food safety is important at every step. So production is now being looked at more. We have regulations in place for the wholesaling end, the retailing end.
Restaurants.
And absolutely, we as consumers have a lot of responsibility too. So Julie's right. There's a lot of work to be done on figuring out what's the proper level of food safety administration at the farm level. While we want safe food and we want to do things that are necessary to help us have that, we also don't want to get in the way of farmers being able to farm profitably and to make a living at what they're doing.
Jessica Werman, there's a lot of stuff in this bill.
There are. I mean, this isn't a small bill, and it's got everything from food safety. It's got everything, obviously, nutrition programs, farm supports, and the thing that when I have talked to the farmers, from Joe's organization, other organizations, the biggest thing for them is the level of certainty that this bill provides. Say you have I mean, this seems to be a fairly good year so far. There's been a ton of rain, though there's always the danger of too much. But say it's a rough year. Last year there were droughts in several areas of Ohio. You need that certainty that you're going to be able to rely on this program if Mother Nature intervenes. So I think when I talk to folks, despite, you know, the huge and massive nature of this, when I talk to farm folks, this is the biggest concern for them, is the uncertainty that's created by not having a bill.
Absolutely. Urban Meyer's coach of the Ohio State Buckeyes. He does not want to have to worry about them changing the rules of the game every year. When he goes out to recruit a young man, he wants someone that's going to fit his football team next year and 2 years and 4 years down the road. Farmers are the same way. They need to know what the rules of the game are, and then they can make their business plans to fit within what those rules are. The other point I would make, too, that follows up on what Jessica was saying in terms of certainty, farmers have been pushing in this round of negotiations to move the public support more into the insurance arena, have a private partnership with the public that it works like homeowners insurance, for example. You buy it, you hope you don't have to use it, but if there's a disaster, it's in place. And I think that seems to be the trend that farmers are pushing more and more towards, is to where the public support does come in, to use it in terms of an insurance type of payment or assistance, as opposed to just writing a check.
The subsidies.
Yes.
Has that been discussed on Capitol Hill, Jessica? Or I read about it, but is it actually being discussed in the committees?
Well, I mean, what do you mean? Is it being more of a market insurance program? Is that
yes?
That's been sort of, and that seems to be the way that the bill seems to be going. Now, there's different crops. So, I mean, there are different crops throughout the country that maybe have more of a subsidy. But that seems to be, in general, particularly for the Ohio farmers that I have talked to, this idea of, if Mother Nature or prices collapse, you've got some sort of backup. You've got some sort of insurance in place. So, and that's been a growing part of the bill.
Okay, so it's in the bill, Joe Cornelia. You're saying more emphasis is needed on that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We recognize that the federal government spends way too much money. It doesn't make sense to just hand over checks. What does make sense is for the government to be there in case we have the kind of disaster that could put farmers out of business and over the long haul influence our food supply.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you hear some sound in the background, that is because we are broadcasting live from the 9th Annual Columbus Public Health Department's Farmers Market at the Department headquarters at 240 Parsons Avenue. Everybody's welcome to this. It's a beautiful day outside, a beautiful day for a farm market. This is the first of three markets. You can learn more at our website at wosu.org/allsides. We're talking about the farm bill for another few minutes. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. The House bill also slashed funding for conservation. Joe, do you know much about that? And isn't that an issue that the Farm Bureau is also concerned with?
Yeah, I don't know the specifics, but in general, not a good idea. I mean, you look at the resource challenges that farmers are going to have to be a part of solving. Algal blooms, clean air. It takes a lot of resources from the federal government to help a study, to research what's going on, to come up with solutions to these kinds of challenges. Certainly we recognize that, again, in this kind of a budget atmosphere, we need to save money, but conservation, while the one we're being told on the one hand the priority is to clean up the environment, then to fund it less, just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Is there any hope for things like that, Jessica Werman, in Washington right now, or that sort of thing going to get cut?
Well, I mean, we're definitely in a cutting environment. Whether mm-hmm. or not that gets restored in the end, we're looking at two very different bills, the Senate and the House. So it's hard to say in the end what ends up being agreed upon. I mean, and that's not necessarily the most controversial point.
Exactly.
That's
not
what they're really
issue.
Fighting. That's not really what they're fighting over. I mean, the fights are really focused on the food stamp or the SNAP program. So that might be something that could change in conference. And, you know, the other thing the other option for this farm bill too is, you know, say the House and Senate conferees get together and they say, you know what, we're going to pass a bill that has nutrition in it, and it's going to be cut, but it's not going to be cut to the level that the House would have cut. You know, does Speaker Boehner go ahead and put that on the floor of the House, and despite the fact that his party doesn't like that kind of bill? So, I mean, there's just so many different ways that this could play out, but it's, you know, September 30 is supposed to be the end date, and nobody's talking about extending it as they did last year.
A provision nixed in the House passed measure, but still in the Senate version. It's a new program, a dairy stabilization program, which would periodically impose quotas on how much milk a farmer can sell, forcing the farmer to reduce production or turn over excess profits to the government. Joe, opponents say that will create price increases in milk and also affect the cheese and other dairy-related industries. Where are you guys on that?
I'm going to let Jessica answer that.
I've been doing
farm stuff for 35 years, and I do not understand dairy
policy. Nobody knows how to explain the dairy program.
I know. It's just we need some rocket surgeon from Ohio State to explain.
I know we're not a big dairy state.
Well,
but
actually, we are. I
think Wisconsin.
Here's what I can tell you about dairy, and part of the reason we have these complicating issues within dairy is the whole structure of the dairy industry is changing. It used to be all small family farms that had 10 or 15 or 25 cows scattered through Ohio and Wisconsin and Minnesota. Now we have extremely large dairies that largely are out west of the California, Idaho, New Mexico region. Plus we have the small family dairies that exist here in our part of the world. They don't always have the same interests. So while I can't explain dairy policy, I can explain why it's hard to figure out.
How about you, Jessica?
Oh, man. Every time the farm bill comes up, and which lately is like every year, because every year they extend it or do something. You know, this is just one of those programs that's so hard to, it's just so in the weeds and so hard to explain and so hard to understand that, I don't even think I'm going to.
Jessica, there's probably about five people in America that are wonkish enough to be able to explain it coherently.
I love it. I just have to ask the questions right now. Terry in Columbus, you're on the air. We just have a couple minutes left in the segment, but I wanted to squeeze you in. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. I grew up in Iowa and around farmers my whole life, but I'm concerned about the insurance programs and the subsidy programs. Let me give an example. I work with a lot of home builders. There's no guarantee for them when the market turned south in 08 and 09. Or for people who are retired and live on the earnings from their stock investment, there was no protection or guarantee against them. And, you know, at least in Iowa, the farms have become much larger, much more agribusiness. And these larger agribusiness farms are getting the lion's share of the subsidies. Mm-hmm. And in Iowa, they are plowing down the sloughs of bad farmland and planting it because the cost to insure that crop is, the insurance cost is much more effective for the farmer. Heck, I'll plant it, I'll insure it. If it turns into corn 1 out of 3 years, I win, and on the other 2 years, I win on the insurance.
Well,
so why are farmers more valuable than other businesses? And do these programs really work?
Okay, Terry. Joe Cornelia, you want to talk a little bit about all started back in the 30s.
Sure. A couple of thoughts in response to what Terry said, and it's a legitimate question, what makes farmers special? Having been around them my entire life, I think they have the characteristics and values that we appreciate here in America. But having said that aside, in terms of the business side of things, one thing about agriculture that very few industries have to cope with like they do is so much of what controls their success is out of their hands. We can't control whether or not we have a drought, if we have too much rain, if we have an early frost. All of these natural occurrences that have implications for farmers. They also exist in a world market. We can't control what the European Union does or what the South Americans do, but those decisions made down there will have implications for the American farmers. So there are a lot of things out of their control. The other thing I would throw out there in terms of why do we have subsidies or insurance at all, I would suggest that that's what we do in America is we set up infrastructure to help take care of each other. We have a minimum wage. so that we assure that people make a certain amount of money. We have nutrition programs like are on display here. We have, well, Terry mentioned the retired people. We have the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation that guarantees that if our bank were to fail up to a certain amount of money, we're going to have our fellow Americans are going to step in and make us whole. So that's kind of what we do. I think it's a legitimate question to ask if farmers are special. We'll resolve that at some point. But I'd also like to point out that agriculture isn't the only segment. Most segments of American society have some type of public guarantee where we take care of each other.
Thank you, Terry, for the call and the question. And I want to thank Joe Cornelli of the Ohio Farm Bureau for joining us today. Thank you for coming out.
Thanks for the invitation. This is fun. You do this well.
Thanks. And Jessica, as always, Jessica Wehrman, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sorry you couldn't be here with us.
I know. I'm sad I missed the food.
We're broadcasting live from the 9th Annual Columbus Public Health Farmers Market at the Health Department headquarters at 240 Parsons Avenue. It's still going on. It's a beauty. It's one of the prettiest days of the year, no question about it. Go to our website at wosu.org/allsides if you want more information. Coming up, we're going to learn more about the SNAP. Well, it's redundant to say program, but SNAP, we're going to learn more about SNAP. And we're going to learn about how it operates in the state of Ohio. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Bioethicist Peggy Batten, an advocate of the right to die, has been wrestling with the issue in her own family. Her husband was in an accident, leaving him with quadriplegia and on life-supporting technology. We'll talk with her on the next Fresh Air. And as Detroit files for bankruptcy, Bruce Katz will describe promising signs of renewal in American cities. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is a beautiful day out here at the 9th Annual Columbus Public Health Department's Farmers Market. It's at the department headquarters here on Parsons Avenue. For more information, check out our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll have a link for you because this is just the first of three markets. You have a chance to check this out, I think, the next two Thursdays. So, but to be sure about that, check out our website at wosu.org/allsides. On July 11th, the House passed a farm bill, but by a narrow margin without one Democratic vote and with plenty of controversy after the funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, more commonly thought of as food stamps. The conflict may be resolved when Senate and House committees convene to work out a compromise, but you heard Jessica Wehrman from Columbus Dispatch. That is very uncertain at this point, very, very unclear. Joining us now to talk about what the SNAP, and let's be redundant, program means to Ohioans and how it works is Ben Johnson from the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thanks. Thank you, Ann. Thanks for having me. You dialed up, I think, the best weather we've had in 2 months. I give all credit to you.
Oh, thank you. I can't take it, but I can't stop looking at the sky either.
It's gorgeous.
How much SNAP money does Ohio get this year? What are we talking about?
We disperse about $3 billion a year. It's all federal money, and we disperse it to about 1.8 million Ohioans. And to give you an idea of what that group of 1.8 million looks like, about 42% of that 1.8 million are children. About 25% live in a household where at least one person works. And about 75% live in a household where at least one person has some form of income. It may be earned income, it may be Social Security or some other form of cash income. But it's an enormous program, and it's gotten bigger since the recession, certainly.
What about seniors? Do they participate in SNAP?
They do. And SNAP is one of the few programs that we administer where able-bodied adults without dependent children are eligible. That's not the case for cash assistance, more commonly called welfare. It's not the case for some of the other programs that we administer. It is the case for SNAP. So there is a, I don't have an exact percentage, but there's a large contingent of elderly individuals who are on the program. There are also individual young adults and middle-aged adults who do not have children and are able-bodied. Many of them work, but because their income is low enough, they're still eligible.
And people who are disabled, they may have Social Security of some form or some kind of income, but they're not able-bodied, they can't work, that sort of thing.
And they would still be eligible. SNAP is an entitlement program, so if you earn 130% of the federal poverty level or less, you are eligible, and you apply at your county Department of Job and Family Services, and you will receive a benefit.
What's 130% of the federal poverty level?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I don't know off the top of my head.
Well, I should know that off the top of my head.
It's the one number I forgot to bring.
So the $3 billion this year, right, and 2012.
Correct.
Is that an increase or a decrease over previous years? How does that work?
It's probably slightly larger than in 2011 or 2012 or 2011 or 2010, although not that much. The caseload rose dramatically during the recession. In more recent months, it has plateaued. I don't know that it's falling yet, but we've seen the caseload level off. We've seen months with slightly higher enrollment and months with slightly lower enrollment. The $3 billion a year has probably been true for the last couple of years.
The job market's improved, but a lot of those jobs don't pay as much as they used to. So it's still a lot of people getting jobs. You said it was about 25%?
About 25% have earned income, and we know that that group includes people who don't work as many hours as they'd like. They work part-time when they'd rather work full-time. They maybe used to have a job that was relatively high-paying, and since the recession, they've been unemployed, and they have now found work, but it's relatively low-paying, as you mentioned. And, of course, we have other programs that are working very hard to address that discrepancy. But yeah, we know that about 25% of the caseload lives in a household where at least one person works.
My guest is Ben Johnson. He's Deputy Director of the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services. We're talking about SNAP. That's the program is more commonly known as food stamps. If you have a question or comment about how the program operates in Ohio, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My trusty associate producer, Rachel Quimby, has told me that 130% of federal poverty level for household of two is $20,628.
That sounds right.
I can't read the rest of it because you guys have to show me the rest of it.
But we got the important stuff.
That's the good stuff. So if anyone out there has a question, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is a typical weekly SNAP benefit or an average? Do you know that?
It's a monthly benefit. It's about $130 per person per month. That can vary, of course, depending on your family makeup and whether or not you have other forms of income. But the average across the state is about $130 per person per month.
And what are people allowed to spend it on?
It's easier to talk about what people are not allowed to spend it on. Prohibited purchases include alcohol, tobacco, vitamins and medicine, hot or prepared food. That would be food at a restaurant or restaurant-style food that you buy at the grocery store. Or non-food items, which sounds obvious, but you think of non-food items that you typically would buy at the grocery store, paper products, pet food, things like that. Those are not eligible purchases. The two that get the most attention, of course, are alcohol and tobacco. The one that is important, but people might not be as aware of, are vitamins and medicines and supplements.
Those are covered?
Prohibited. Are prohibited purchases. Yeah, the program is designed to purchase food and only food.
In Congress recently, opponents of SNAP were making a big deal about a guy who had won $2 million in the lottery in Michigan and was still accepting his SNAP benefit. Is that typical? What do we know about the fraud in the SNAP?
That's not typical. We're certainly not so naive to think that fraud doesn't exist, but fraud is not endemic to the program. We work very hard not just to detect fraud and put a stop to it, but to deter it before it happens. We work at the state level very closely with the Ohio Investigative Unit. It's the same group of investigators that investigate alcohol violations, and they have undercover officers that investigate retailers that may be allowing prohibited purchases. They may be trafficking in cards. People sell their cards for pennies on the dollar, and then the retail traffics in that essentially what becomes a cash product. At the county level, our county offices, the county departments of Job and Family Services, work on their own and in close collaboration with local law enforcement to investigate cardholder fraud, people who are selling their cards or buying prohibited items or anything like that. The cards are issued to the household. They're for use only by that household. They come with a PIN number, and anybody who is transferring their card or attempting to buy a prohibited item, even if they have the best of intentions, which is conceivable from time to time, they need something like diapers or something like that. Even if they have the best of intentions, it's not allowed. It's fraudulent, and we will put a stop to it.
That's why, I guess, at the food banks, they're often asking for personal items, toothpaste, toothbrushes, all those kind of things, diapers and so forth, because they're not covered.
That would be one reason. And also, the name of the program is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and we know that $130 per person per month in many cases will not cover a family's entire food need for that month. We support the food pantries and the Ohio Association of Food Banks. In the budget that the governor just signed, there's $14.5 million each year that will go directly to the Ohio Association of Food Banks, and they will use that to purchase food, because we know that many of the clients there are the same clients we're serving at the county offices.
The food banks are working pretty closely with the state now in outreach and getting people signed up. So if someone comes into the food bank, particularly a lot of people in the suburban areas who have never been on any kind of aid before, they don't know what to do. Do you do a lot of outreach at those places now?
We do. We have a close partnership with the Association of Food Banks called the Ohio Benefit Bank, and it's a great program, and people can go to their local food pantry or to another Ohio Benefit Bank location and get assistance with filling out an application and find out what they might be eligible, not just food assistance, but cash assistance or Medicaid or any of the other programs that fall under the state human services umbrella.
Ed in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, everybody. How are you guys doing?
Fine.
Hi, Ed.
Beautiful day. So I'll make this quick. My question is, with programs like SNAP, if I'm an employer and I'm not paying the greatest wage, does that give me a disincentive to try to increase the wages of the people who work for me when I know they can go to the government and get these types of programs to help feed themselves?
Well, that's a high-level policy and theoretical question that I don't know if I'm equipped to answer. Like I said, we do know that there's a large percentage of the population that collects food assistance that is also working. What impact that has on wages probably varies depending on the company and the part of the state and even the country. The eligibility for SNAP is set at the federal level, so there's not flexibility here at the state to change that. I think, like I said, the impact that has on wages probably varies.
Thanks a lot, Ed. That's an interesting question, though, that kind of interdependency. It's you know, all connected.
Well, we know we talk a lot about work supports, and work supports are programs that help people get back to work and help people not just find a job but keep a job. And we know that for a certain percentage of the caseload, SNAP is a work support. It's not as much a traditional welfare program as it is a program that allows them to keep a job, that even if it's relatively low paying now, may pay dividends down the road, may present the opportunity for promotion or better opportunities.
Now, we call them food stamps because that's what we've always called them, but they aren't food stamps anymore. You issue credits on debit cards, right? Has that helped reduce fraud, or are you saying people are selling their cards too? Did you say that earlier?
Well, there are some people who sell their cards. I don't want to overstate that.
Right.
Like I said, the vast majority of the caseload are good people
but
who are in a difficult
spot. But has it helped reduce fraud?
It has. It has. There was no good way to track a paper stamp, an actual food stamp. With the card, we can more closely look at patterns in the data. And actually, Ohio is one of four states that just joined a data sharing agreement with USDA. USDA licenses all of the retailers. So anybody who wants to accept SNAP has to be licensed through USDA. And then we, of course, determine eligibility for the individuals. When we match our data with USDA's data, we can look for red flags and anomalies that might indicate fraud. An easy example would be a market somewhere in Columbus that's attracting a large number of cardholders from other counties, from Licking County or Union County. It seems unlikely that someone would drive that far just to do their regular grocery shopping. It could be an indication that retailer is willing to sell alcohol or tobacco or another prohibited item.
How much do we know about whether SNAP recipients are taking advantage of the Farmers Market program? I guess there's the Ohio EBT Farmers Market Demonstration Project.
Yes. We don't have specific data on how much money people are spending at the farmers markets, but we do know that the program is growing, and we love the program. It's a fabulous program. Last year, there were about 66 farmers markets across the state that participated. This year, it should be closer to 74 or 75. It's grown every year that we've had it, and we love the program for three real reasons. It's great for the individuals in the program. It makes it easy for them to get access to fresh, healthy produce. It's great for farmers. It's a great way to support our Ohio farmers. And it's great for the communities. I think a lot of communities have started farm markets as a community development and sometimes as simple as a nice thing to do on a Saturday morning. And we want to be supportive of that and supportive of our communities. And so we really like the program. And any farm market that's interested in participating can go to our website, jfs.ohio.gov, and get more information.
I was going to say, what about farmers? How does the state make it convenient for them to participate? Is that one of the roadblocks? Is just the bureaucracy?
Well, what we do is we work with the market, and the market sets up the card swipe machine, and we haven't even have grant money available that we can give to markets that will help them purchase the card swipe machine. And then they will swipe the user's card and give them a certain number of tokens, and then they can use those tokens with the retailers at the market. We also, I should mention, support farmers through a program called the Commodity Program, which we give money. It's about $1.5 million a year to food banks. Food banks use some percentage of that money to pay farmers to pick surplus crop.
Okay.
And then that comes into the food banks.
All right. Well, Ben Johnson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Anytime.
Nice to get out of the office today, huh?
It's beautiful.
Ben Johnson, he's Deputy Director of the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services. We've been broadcasting live from the 9th Annual Columbus Public Health Farmers Market at the Health Department headquarters at 240 Parsons Avenue. Everyone's welcome. This is the first of three markets. For more information, check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. I want to thank the All Sides crew, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban, Shannon Clary, and Leticia Wiggins, and Emmanuel Jochi, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. I can't forget to say thanks so much today to Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. They're always here with us on these remotes. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of Ohio State University.